fall. Baby, it's not mine. Not a chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are right smack dab in the middle of it. Right smack dab in the middle. We are right smack dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We've got just a fine guest with us this evening, Colin Diggs, out of the Philadelphia area. And he's the author of Reaching the Finish Line. And some of his work has been published on Genesis Communications Network. He's helped virtually hundreds of people reach the finish line through his lectures, career consultations, and coaching programs. His Reaching the Finish Line tour, and that begins just soon, very soon next week. It begins here in Austin, Texas on September 16th at the University of Texas. And Colin currently lives in Austin and is empowered to fulfill his mission in bringing our nation's employment rate under 5%. Welcome to our program this evening, Colin Diggs.
Thank you, George, for having me.
Well, I tell you what, this is a wonderful title. And what inspired you on this Reaching the Finish Line, A Practical Guide to Discovering the Champion in You is a subtitle. What inspired you to write this book, Colin Diggs?
Well, the main thing, George, I would say the main inspiration is the ongoing occurrence of seeing people stuck. And a lot of times people get stuck and people are not getting to where they want to be. And that always bothered me because I feel like everyone has enormous potential. And being an average Joe is just a choice. It's not necessarily someone's fate. But for some people, it could be perfectly fine. However, the ultimate question that I like to ask people is if they're happy with their life. So this book serves as a bridge and also is an inspiration to me right here.
Right. What are some of the factors that prevent people from reaching the finish line, from being successful?
Okay, there's several ones. The first one is I would say that they're just not ready. A lot of people, for example, a lot of people would say, I'm ready to take on this new career opportunity, or I'm ready to do whatever they may aspire. Simply, just not ready. I think one of the reasons why they're not ready, George, is they're not being honest with themselves. A lot of times, people lie to themselves because it sounds good for them saying it, or they say it because it sounds pleasing to other people's ears. But in reality, they're not being honest with themselves, and what they're doing is fooling themselves. And that kind of goes on to the next one. I think the next one is, as far as people not being ready, is they fear the unknown. They kind of fear what's ahead. But the thing about it is, everything is unknown. We go outside. We go to work. We don't know if we're going to get hit by a bus. We don't know if someone's going to rob us. We don't know if we're going to, if something's going to happen. I mean, everything is unknown. We can't really predict life. That's something that we're constantly always living is life. So, kind of fearing the unknown, that's something that if people realize that they encounter that all the time, then when it comes to opportunities, they could be more confident in going forward. And the next factor, as far as being not ready, is bad influences. And it's kind of common sense going out saying, if you hang around, there's several types of influences. You have one influence where people can repel you and show you you're successful. Or you can hang around a type of crowd who's going to hold you back and not be successful. And people, I mean, of course, anyone can't be ready if they're hanging around bad influences. So another
You came out of a pretty rough neighborhood, didn't you, in Philadelphia? You had to overcome some of these things personally, did you not?
Absolutely, George. Absolutely. I was born and raised in an area in where if you called the police, they would say, okay, we'll be out there. But they wouldn't show up, you know. So the client was high, and a lot of client would kind of go off the radar because a lot of police wasn't very attentive to all the districts in the neighborhood. And a lot of times, and it's gotten better, George, but it hasn't gotten a whole lot better. But a lot of times they will play, as far as police segregation, I guess I would call it monitoring segregation, and where some areas they will cover and where other areas they would just totally ignore. And, but yeah, it was very hard. And coming, and where I came from, you know, there was lots of people, they were selling drugs, a lot of other crime and, illegal activities. And it was definitely hard. But, that's what it kind of goes into my next one.
Sure,
next one is basic. And that's motivation. And motivation is, in order for someone to be motivated, they have to be ready. So, to be motivated, you have to have a motive. For example, if a person wants to go to college, okay, they're motivated to go to college because there's a motive behind it. They're motivated to change careers because there's a motive behind it. So basically, motivation is simply the feeling, while motive is simply the reason. So that's kind of the difference between motive and motivation. Another factor I will also say is a lack of discipline. Now, this is a big one, George, because a lot of people do not have this. One thing that people get caught up as far as lack of discipline is something called procrastination. And studies have shown 95% of people are procrastinators in some form, while 25% of the 95% are chronic procrastinators. So procrastination, this was really preventing us from reaching the finish line. It was really holding us back. And within that procrastination is something that we call bad habits. And for some people, it could be sitting on the couch watching TV all day. And everyone has their own habits. But those are just several things that prevent people from reaching the finish line.
Right. You say it in your book that, how about a college degree? Is that good advice now, or are there other alternatives to making an honest living?
Yes, sir. This is a great question. When it comes to a college degree, I really think it depends on the major. So if a person wants to be a doctor, of course, they should go to college. I mean, they're going to be able to be a doctor anyway. No one's going to trust them to work on a doctor's degree. But if it's like an industry like STEM, which stands for science, technology, engineering, mathematics, a general rule is a person should go to college. It would be helpful. They would probably end up getting a good career out there. But now, when you look at something like, let's say, a person wants to start their own business, George. I know a lot of students who go to college for business, and I say, why do you go to college for business? They say, well, I want to start my own business. And they don't realize that you don't have to go to college to start your own business. In effect, a lot of people who go to school for business actually end up not owning their business. They're just working for someone else. You're just basically running someone else's business. And you don't have to go to college to run someone else's business. People do all the time. You have managers of HEB who didn't go to college. You have managers of these other big, these big box stores who don't have a college degree. So it's not necessary. And the thing about it, you probably can get some value in college, but the thing that everyone faces, or most people face at least, is the student loan debt. And people take years after decades trying to get that paid off. And without it, it can make a big difference.
Right. You know, they're burdened. Many of these students that are graduating, recent graduates, what they owe, $30,000, $40,000 or more in debt. I mean, do they ever overcome that? That's a burden on them trying to even pay that back. Are you saying here that self-employment could be a solution to getting out there and getting employed also?
Absolutely, George. Absolutely. That's something I talk about in my book, Reaching the Finish Line. There's a person can be self-employed. There's still several ways. So a person may choose to person may choose to do something called, let's say, in the book I talk about event promotions, and where basically where you work with a broker, and they'll basically hire you to conduct event promotions for their clients. So one example is a person may, the broker may have a client like AT&T, and they may want to promote something like a back-to-school program. They may want to get students to enroll in their cell phone plans. Well, what the broker would do is, the broker won't do the job. They'll look for young people to act, and they will hire them, almost sometimes, you know, not just young people, but for a back-to-school program, most likely young people. But what they would do is they will look for people to hire them to actually subcontract out for the client. And for a lot of people, that could be a great way to be self-employed, and where those jobs could pay anywhere between $15 to $25 an hour, even in some areas, and that's a good way to be self-employed. Another way a person can be self-employed is simply having their own cleaning business. I see a lot of these things going, and where a person basically, you know, especially Texas is a very good state, you know, very pro small business. What a person can do is they can open up a DBA or open up a small LLC, and they can pick up clients on their way in their community, and they can start cleaning commercial offices and things of that manner. And that's another way a person can be self-employed. So definitely self-employed definitely has benefits. And if you don't want to have to worry about, working under a boss or being told what to do, that self-employed definitely gives you that comfort.
Right, and the internet has opened up a myriad of ways and opportunities to become self-employed, and you can get a PayPal account and other things and get credit cards cleared. It's just really helpful, isn't it?
It is, George. Really, there is no excuse why a person not consider being self-employed. Like you said, George, you have PayPal. You also have Bitcoin. I know a lot of people are getting involved in that as well, too. There's really no excuse. If you can have a person be self-employed strictly through the internet. You can have like a small internet business. Sometimes people have these social media, marketing, online businesses, internet marketing businesses where they help clients, help other small businesses promote their business through social media, through SEO, through PPC, which is pay-per-click. Again, there's really no excuse why a person couldn't be self-employed.
Now, you have a Facebook notice up for your up-and-coming lecture next Tuesday here, September 16th, and that's in Burdeen Hall on the campus of the University of Texas at Austin. Is that right?
Yes, George. That's going to be at 5:30. The doors open at 5 o'clock, and I'm going to be it's a talk I'm going to be giving. It's actually going to mark the first date of the Reaching the Finish Line tour. I'll be talking about three things, which is how to make your goals bulletproof, how to change careers without going back to school, and how to get paid working from home. It's a free event. Everyone is welcome to come out. And it will be great to see people come out there, and I feel like the information will be of great value to the person. But one thing you must do, though, you have to RSVP because seating is limited. So you can't just show up and expect you to get a seat. You must RSVP, and you can go to reachingthefinishline.com to do that.
Okay. And another thing here, you're really concerned, it seems like, in your writings here about the condition of this country, and could we become a Spain or a Greece if we're not careful somewhere in here?
George, I think that if we continue to go down that path, I like to be optimistic about things, but if we continue to go down that path, it's quite possible. However, I always tell my followers, subscribers, and readers that you have to take control of your own life, your own destiny, your own financial prosperity. You can't put it in the hands of government. You can't put it in the hands of corporations. You have to take control of yourself, and that's by you being proactive. That that's why the book is called Reaching a Finish Line. It's not the government reaching the finish line for you. It's not corporations reaching the finish line for you. It's you reaching the finish line. So that's what kind of comes to it, being independent.
Now, you went to the university up in Philadelphia, right?
Yes, up at Penn State University, George.
Yeah, and you graduated with a degree. What kind of a degree?
A nutrition degree.
And it took a lot of hard work, didn't it, huh?
It did, George. It did. You know, it was, you know, and I would definitely recommend people who are considering college. If you want to go to college, go to community college first. If you feel like college is a good fit for you, go to community college first, do your 2 years, then go to and four, then transfer to the other 2 years at a 4 year on school. A lot of times, students, you know, do their first 2 years at a 4 year degree school. As big as Penn State is and so many activities going on, it can be so easy to get distracted. And that's something that I wouldn't recommend. So, if you feel like college is a good fit for you, you know, do 2 years at community college before doing your other two at a four-year university. Now, there's other ways you can obviously cut through college. And the one way, for example, is I know a lot of times, especially in this economy, George, and perhaps we could talk about the unemployment rate maybe in a little bit, especially in this economy, a lot of students don't have money to afford tuition. You know, sometimes they have their parents to do their financial aid for them to help them pay for school, and they hope that the financial aid comes through. Sometimes, you know, in my case, where my parents are in my life, you know, that's something I had to do myself, you know, which was even more difficult because I didn't have a lot of money at that age. But one way to really cut your costs low is to go through something called credit via examination. And these simply are courses these are accredited courses. These courses could be used at any college to transfer and to use and help you graduate. But these courses are mainly courses that you will do in your first 2 years, like college algebra, like mathematics, like sociology, psychology. You can do these courses, but you'll actually pay a fraction of the cost. Most of the time you pay for a college course now, you're going to pay about, you know, $400, you know. But with these courses, you're going to pay about maybe $100. You know, we're talking about three credit courses. You know, most courses you're going to pay at least three times that. So I would advise that, again, it's called credit by examination. And I talk about that well in depth in the book. I actually provide a guide, a specific guide that a reader can go through to make it easier for them. So they know all the classes to take. They'll know how to finish, how to get all their general education done in the least amount of time.
Right. We've got about 2 minutes left. What would be your closing comments?
Okay, George. With anything, I would suggest people to, go to reachingthefinishline.com. Again, the event's going to be on Tuesday, September 16th at 5:30.
At Birdie Hall. Yeah.
Yeah. At Birdie Hall, room 112. Doors open at 5:00. Okay. And one thing I want to do is for all of Secret Truth listeners, can you send me an email at Callen, that's K as in King, A as in Amy, L as in Lucy, L as in Larry, E as in Ed, N as in Nancy. Callen at reachingthefinishline.com. Just put a subject title, a free gift. I'll be happy to send you a free gift, and that's all. That's for Secret Truth listeners.
Right, we're going to have this up also. It's up there right now on our site. Your contact information. So you go to thesecrettruth.com, and you'll be able to pick up on Callen Diggs, KALLENDIGGS. And Reaching the Finish Line, and you can discover the champion in you. Boy, Callen, thank you very much, Callen Diggs, for being with us this evening. And you can be reached at 512-660-7535. Again, that's 512-660-7535 or reachingthefinishline.com. Thank you very much for being with us, Callen Diggs, and we certainly appreciate the fine advice. And boy, you've got a nice book there, and I know it's going to be successful. Thank you for being with us. Okay. Good night. Thank you, Colin Diggs, for that fine book interview. Coming up next is a interview, a rebroadcast that Charlotte Littlefield and I had on April 12, 2008 with Joseph Farrell. So we hope that you really enjoy this insightful piece. There were actually 2 hours, so you can look for the second hour on the secrettruth.com site. But thank you for being with us this evening.
And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. This is George Butler along with
Charlotte Littlefield Brown.
Boy, do we have a program tonight, huh, Charlotte?
Yeah, George, how are you tonight?
Oh, okay. How about yourself? Everything going great?
Everything's going awesome.
We've got Dr. Joseph P. Farrell tonight. He has a doctorate in patristics from the University of Oxford and pursues research now in physics and alternative history and science. Welcome to our program, Dr. Joseph Farrell. We really are going to enjoy these 2 hours.
Hi, George and Charlotte. Thank you for having me on.
You have written a series of books lately. Tell us a little bit about how did you come to begin to write like this? You're quite a prolific writer.
Well, I've always been interested, George, in physics and alternative history things. And when I retired from teaching college, I figured I didn't have any academic politics to worry about.
Hey, I'm doctor. I like you already. Hey, Charlotte, this guy's clued in, isn't he, huh? Charlotte's assistant, me tonight on the show. She's my, co-host. And Charlotte?
Yes, George?
Yeah, I just want to welcome Dr. Farrell there.
Absolutely.
Okay, so Dr. Farrell, go on. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, that's all right. I just decided that I might as well start writing some of these things. And in a certain way, one of my former professorial colleagues, she and I had taught several kind of interdisciplinary seminars together, and I presented in outline some of the ideas from the first books to the seminar, and had a fairly good reception from the students, and she encouraged me that I should actually try and write them up. And so after I retired, I figured I might as well do that, and that's kind of how all these things came to be.
I see. Your latest book is what we're featuring tonight,
mm-hmm.
and it's called The Secrets of the Unified Field, The Philadelphia mm-hmm. Experiment, The Nazi Bell, and The Discarded Theory. So what you did, you brought together three things seemingly unconnected, but they are connected in a way. Is that sort of your view on this?
Oh, yes, definitely. The connection really is that discarded theory, which is, of course, some of the unified field theories from the late 1920s and 1930s that began to be published in Germany. And, of course, the most famous of them would be the theory that Einstein kind of first published in 1928, although he hinted at papers that he had published earlier than that, that he was thinking along those lines. But I really do believe that that more or less is the conceptual basis to those two very, very secret experimental projects from World War II. And there's more to the story, but I mean that ultimately is the basis of them.
I see. So you're saying that some of these earlier theories were very valid and were used to further some of these experiments.
Well, the validity, let's
okay.
back up just a bit there.
Okay.
If you look at modern physics texts, they will tell you, quite rightly, that those unified field theories from that period of history were incomplete in that they only unified geometry gravity and electromagnetism. And they were geometric theories, and that's kind of an important part of the story because, of course, the basic insight that Einstein had in general relativity, and which he pursued in his unified field theories, was that you could describe the physical forces by means of a geometry. So in other words, the geometry was the force, and the force was the geometry. And he extended this idea in 1928 in his first unified field theory publication, in which he basically derived a common geometry of gravity and electromagnetism. But there are two other physical forces that quantum mechanics revealed, and they are, of course, the strong and weak nuclear forces. So physicists very quickly renounced these theories as being incomplete, but there's an important point to remember. And it was a point that very, very few people ever really encounter unless they really dig. And certainly you don't find this particular individual talked very much about, even in popular histories of this period in physics. You know, he's never mentioned by Dr. Michio Kaku, for example, in any of his popular books. But the man's name is Gabriel Krohn. And he was a very, very influential, very brilliant Hungarian electro engineer. And what he demonstrated as early as 1935, he won a prize for this paper from the University of Liège in Belgium. He demonstrated that you could take the geometry of some of these unified field theories, and in particular Einstein's 28 version, and use it to describe some of the anomalous behavior of electrical networks and electrical machines. So that may not seem like a big deal, but it really is, because what he did by doing that was he showed that these unified field theories were not just theory. You could actually take what they said and bring it right down into the laboratory bench. And the real key here is that what the unified field theories themselves were saying was that space-time was locally engineerable. And when he made that step, when he made that demonstration in that paper, what he really was saying is that we have the key and the tool to engineer space-time locally. Now, once you've said that, of course, you're going to come to the attention of the Nazis across the border, and ultimately, of course, in this country, where he makes his home, you're certainly going to come to the attention of the American military.
And so what does that mean about making it locally engineerable? What does that exactly mean?
Well, ultimately, if you have a physics which permits you to engineer the fabric of space-time itself, you have a physics with the potential to lead you to all three of the following things. You have, first of all, a physics that will permit some sort of field propulsion. In other words, the potential is there that you do an end run around rockets and jet aircraft and all of that. The second thing that you have the potential to acquire is the ability to tap into the energy of the physical vacuum, which is, you know, according to quantum theory, just teeming with energy. So in other words, you have a potential solution to the dependence on oil, fossil fuels, and things of this sort. You can basically free yourself from non-renewable resources for your energy. And the third thing, and the most disturbing thing that it leads to, is if you have that kind of physics with that kind of energy available, potentially, by an application of Krohn's work to these theories, then you have a potential weapon that would make a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker. So in other words, there's all three of these areas, and of course the American military and of course the German military would certainly be interested in all of them.
You seem to bring into this later on the Bell itself. Did the Bell have application in research around what your the weapon system?
Definitely.
And
in fact, that's a good question, because the Third Reich. I'm of the belief that the Third Reich's atomic bomb program was far more successful than we have been led to believe. But I say that as kind of context to put how they viewed the Bell into perspective, because it alone, in all of the fantastic secret weapons projects that the Third Reich was developing, it alone was given the highest classification in their classification scheme, and that was Kriegsentscheidend, which translates as decisive for the war, and that's higher than their A-bomb project.
Okay, we've got to cut away for a break here, but we'll be right back. Boy, this is getting interesting, and I want to ask you about Heisenberg and Niels Bohr. We're going to talk some real deep physics here. Be right back. Thank you. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with
Charlotte Littlefield Brown.
Welcome back, Dr. Farrell.
Thank you, George.
As you were saying, The Nazis were further along, in your opinion, on creating some kind of a nuclear device or the Bell device. What exactly do you mean?
Well, both. We have to understand that the two projects, the Nazi atom bomb project and the Bell, are two entirely different projects. But I do happen to believe that, you know, I wrote a whole book, in fact, about the Nazi atom bomb project and some of their other secret weapons called Rife of the Black Sun. But in it, I basically came to the conclusion on the basis of information that finally was kind of kicked loose from National Archives after German reunification, that basically the Nazi atom bomb was much farther along and in fact may have even successfully tested a couple of nuclear bombs prior to the end of the war. So, you know, the picture is very, very different from that painted in the textbooks, but the Bell was something entirely different.
And can I ask you this, sir?
Sure.
So one of the fundamental underlying differences between what they were doing and what the Western physicists were doing is that Western physicists assumed that the local space-time vacuum could not be curved.
No, that's not entirely true. I think they did assume that. But other than the Philadelphia Project, there are no indications that any of the Western allies pursued any secret weapon project based on some of those unified field theories. That's the
right.
One lone exception. The Nazis, on the other hand, rationalized their experiments with the Bell very, very carefully. So one of the key differences between the Philadelphia experiment and the Nazi Bell is I think that we had a certain handle on some of the implications of those unified field theories because, after all, they were the basis for the experiment. But when we actually performed the experiment, you know, according to the basic legend that Carlos Allende circulated, we ran into some sort of threshold. We crossed some sort of threshold, and the experiment ran away and achieved results that we were not expecting. But if you examine the record of the Bell, it's very clear that the Nazis set it up with the full intention of discovering some of these anomalous properties. So there's the key difference.
Okay.
But in all other respects, I think that both sides rationalized it on the basis of these unified field theories.
Okay.
So the Bell, tell us the difference between, say, a nuclear device the Germans were developing and the Bell. How would they differ? In two different kinds of weapon systems.
Okay, well, the atom bomb, of course, is reliant upon the fission of either a uranium-235 or a plutonium-239 critical mass. And, of course, when that's done, a tremendous amount of energy is released. But that energy is not really directly drawing anything from the physical vacuum, although I'll mention something in a moment here that I believe that nuclear devices do in that respect.
Okay.
But the Nazi Bell, on the other hand, was an attempt to tap into this local space-time curvature very directly. So in other words, there is, again, the potential is there for them to have acquired some sort of weapon that would have been much, much more powerful even than our most powerful hydrogen bombs, which, of course, are several orders of magnitude more powerful than an atom bomb. So, you know, there's no real wonder why the Nazis classified this particular project so highly. Now, I don't believe that they pursued this project any farther than basically working out a prototype technology to tap into those three areas I mentioned earlier, you know, field propulsion and energy production and a potential weapon. I don't believe that they had any intention with this device other than to develop that prototype technology. But they were wildly successful from all indications in doing so. Now, I mentioned nuclear bombs. There is an aspect, I believe, of nuclear weapons that does tap in to the local space-time curvature. And the reason I say that is that when America tested its first hydrogen bomb, a bomb by the name of Mike, in 1952, we had calculated a yield for the device of between 4 to 6 megatons. But when it was actually fired off, the detonation ran away to about 10 megatons, which, of course, is just a colossal error of calculation. And I think that one of the reasons this happened, and I think it's one of the most closely held secrets of the thermonuclear powers, United States, Russia, France, Great Britain, and so on, is that they discovered that the yields of these devices would vary slightly depending on the time and place that they detonated them. And therefore, that means that the local celestial geometry and therefore the local space-time curvature is going to be slightly different and affect the yield. And that's why I think the more recent additions to the nuclear club keep testing these things, because they've discovered this and they're trying to learn some of these laws.
So there was concern, I remember, back during those tests about setting off some kind of an uncontrollable chain reaction. Is that sort of pointing in the direction of what you've just explained there in a way?
No, not really,
not
because the scare back then really was that by starting a thermonuclear fusion reaction, it would do the same thing with the hydrogen in the atmosphere and basically turn the Earth into a funeral pyre.
Yes, uh-huh.
So, in other words, their whole rationalization of that fear was that simply it was a thermonuclear chain reaction that was going to be set off. But what I'm talking about is that when you implode one of those devices, you're creating at the very center of that detonation a geometry that in turn is tapping into some of these geometries that you get as a result of these unified field theories, and in particular, a particular mathematical transform called the torsion tensor. Now, what the torsion tensor does, just to kind of give you a simple illustration, if you take a soda can and empty it out completely, and then take it in your hands and wring it like a dish rag, it spirals and folds and pleats local space-time. So in other words, when you create that tremendous amount of stress at the center of one of those detonations, you're doing essentially the same thing. You're creating a very local, very powerful folding, twisting, and pleating of space-time. That energy gates into the reaction. So I think this is really what's going on there. It really doesn't have anything to do with those other fears that were current back in the 1950s.
My gosh, these when we say scalar, is that to do with this local potential of this curvature of and imploding some of this energy or bringing some of this energy in? Is that connected to this?
Pardon me?
Is scalar connected to what you just said?
Oh yes, definitely.
Okay.
A scalar is a mathematical entity, really, of the tensor calculus. It's a dimensionless entity, and every now and then on talk shows, you get people that have some knowledge of these things, and they call in and will say things to the effect that, scalar physics doesn't exist because a scalar is nothing but a pure magnitude. It's dimensionless, and it really has no physical meaning. But in point of fact, if you go back into the physics literature, particularly around the turn of the last century, there was a brilliant English physicist by the name of E.T. Whittaker that took this scalar, or the scalar potential.
Okay, we got to cut away here. We'll continue with this in just a few minutes. Thank you very much. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with
Charlotte Littlefield Brown.
Welcome back, Joseph Farrell.
Thank you, George. Nice to be here.
What were we talking about? You said some English scientists had done a lot of work in the area of...
They call that torsion physics now?
Yeah, well, actually, the two are slightly different, but, for our purposes, we can use the terms interchangeably. But the physicist I was going to mention before the break is a fellow by the name of E.T. Whittaker, and he published a series of rather interesting and breathtaking papers prior to general relativity in 1903. And basically all he did was he took this scalar potential and he demonstrated that it was composed of bidirectional longitudinal waves of stress in the fabric of space-time itself. And that's a rather breathtaking thing to say, because a longitudinal wave is a tremendously powerful wave, and the way I kind of illustrate it for people is that we're familiar more with Hertz waves, which of course is the radio signals that we're listening to now. And if we take a jump rope and stretch them between people and have one person you know, jerk the rope up and down, it's going to transmit a sine wave or a standard Hertz wave to the other person. But most of the energy in that transmission will be dissipated. But if you take the same two people and put a yardstick between them and have one of them kind of pulse it or push it, then most of that energy is going to be transmitted almost instantaneously to the other person. And that's what a longitudinal wave does. It's kind of like a sound wave, only we have to think of it in terms of kind of a sound wave in the fabric of space-time itself.
Tom Bearden, did he pioneer or do some research in the last few years? And also Richard Hoagland, that seems to ring a bell.
Oh, yes.
Did they both come together and do some mutual research together?
I've corresponded with both men. I know Mr. Hoagland rather well. And I know that he is certainly aware of Lieutenant Colonel Bearden's work, and certainly they both have talked about similar conceptions in physics. I don't know, I'm not aware that they've ever done any work together in this area.
Okay. But I know longitudinal and scalar weapons. I know Tom Bearden he's got a couple of books out. I think we received those, Charlotte received those the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in depth on scalar weapon systems. And he has a treatment in his books about the Russians being far advanced ahead of us in this area. Is that true?
Well, I don't know if that's entirely true. I have a slightly different analysis of scalar weapons. And, in fact, I review a lot of Lieutenant Colonel Bearden's work in a book of mine called The SS Brotherhood of the Bell. And the reason I do is I don't think that his historical reconstruction of the development of these things is exactly correct. I really think that it's Nazi Germany that begins to research these types of weapons, and by means precisely, once again, of this Bell device. So I think it comes ultimately from there. I do agree with him that there's every indication that the Soviet Union pursued this research further after the war and came to some very kind of astonishing and breathtaking conclusions. In fact, I'm writing a book right now where I devote a whole portion of the book to that research.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead, Charlotte?
Oh, yeah, I was going to ask, just for my better understanding, I'm mm-hmm. still a little confused about the term, the semantic of scalar.
Mm-hmm. Well, the term itself is a technical term of the mathematical language that's used to describe these things. And in that term, again, it's like I say, it's a term for a dimensionless entity, okay?
Okay.
But as I'm trying to point out with this reference to this English physicist, he showed mathematically that term could be analyzed. In other words, it wasn't truly a scalar at all. It had internal information content within it. And once one learned how to analyze it, then it leads to these horrendously powerful weapons.
Okay.
Does that make some sense?
Yes, that helped quite a bit, actually.
You know, at the end of World War II, weren't both sides, Russia and America, they ran in there and grabbed up all these scientists that they could,
yes.
Like von Braun, I think, came to our side.
Sure.
And the Russians got some missile scientists. Well, did they get, do you think, some of the scalar scientists more than we did or not?
I think that, well, this is an excellent, excellent question, and it really opens up a Pandora's box about the history of the end of the war. The Bell device itself, along with all of its project documentation, and the general that was the overall head of this project, as well as the head of all of other, of Nazi Germany's other secret weapons projects, all of these things go entirely missing at the end of World War II. In fact, there is strong evidence to suggest that they went missing on a massive six-engine, ultra-heavy lift, long-range aircraft called a Junkers 390. Now, this aircraft was capable of flying nonstop from Germany to Argentina. So, in other words, you know, this was just an enormous aircraft.
My gosh, right? It was.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to lose one of these things.
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, this is the mysterious thing about the Bell, because it goes completely missing.
Well, you know, Project Paperclip, they were bringing through ratlines many of those scientists out to Argentina and America and so forth.
Right.
Is that true?
Right. Well, yeah. I think, you know, the history, and again, to kind of bring it back to your question about the Soviet Russians, the lines of where the bell might have gone, I think, are basically two possibilities. It either went to Argentina and disappeared into some post-war, independent, ongoing Nazi research project, which is my preferred view, in fact, or it disappeared into this country, along with this SS general, into our black ops projects. So that's basically where the trail seems to lead at this point of the research. Now, the Russians enter this picture in a very interesting way, because what they got their hands on was a portion of some of this scalar research that was indicated to the Germans in some of their very secret radar experiments at the end of the war. And they took this radar team into the Soviet Union just, I think around March or April of 1945, just as the war is drawing to a close. And they continued this experimentation for several years until about 1955. They release the German that was in charge of this radar team. He makes his way back to Germany. His name is Dr. Hellman, oddly enough. And then he goes to Brazil, where he continues to work for the Brazilians, of all people, on these similar weapons. And he makes some very interesting claims that the Russians were developing weapons that could literally drain the energy out of the ocean and freeze it, or load energy into things and make them explode and so on and so forth. Well, all of this is a signature of scalar physics. So it's very clear that the Russians were doing something, but we really don't know until after the fall of the Soviet Union what they were really up to.
You know, go ahead, Charlotte.
Oh, I was going to ask, is there an example of this in our popular culture, the Indiana Jones series?
I'm not sure I'm understanding your question.
Well, there was a what I can only interpret as a scalar weapon in the Indiana Jones series, where they're looking for the Lost Ark, and they go to India, and they, you know, and there's this one scene where this this item basically just destroys everybody.
Are you talking about the Ark?
No, it's a scalar. Never mind. I was wondering if you'd seen any examples of scalar like the bell or something in action in popular culture.
Well, with respect to the Indiana Jones movies, no, not directly. The interesting thing about those movies is, of course, the idea that you have teams of Nazis, and then with the new movie that's coming out, Soviets, scouring the world for ancient high technology. And, you know, this certainly was an interest of the Nazis. So in that respect, I think that there may be kind of a very dim and very complicated sort of connection, because I do think when you read the ancient texts, you find signatures of these weapons.
I would say that if it went to Argentina, well, that we've got America dominating that area, the Rockefellers and everybody else, so we've probably got that technology with the secret Nazis we brought here anyway. Hey, we're going to take another break. We'll be right back, Dr. Farrell. Thank you very much. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with
Charlotte Littlefield Brown.
Welcome back, Dr. Farrell.
Well, thank you. I thought of something over the break that kind of may answer Charlotte's question a little better about finding scalar weapons in the popular culture. So if I may I...
Sure, go ahead. You bet.
Well, I think if you look to the movies, you do find evidence of these things, particularly in George Lucas's Star Wars films. You know, the whole idea of a lightsaber is a very scalar idea, because if you know what this kind of physics is, it produces its effects by interfering beams of electromagnetic energy in a particular area and creating basically a standing wave, which, if it's intense enough, will basically slice through anything it comes into contact with. So you have that. And then you have the whole Death Star itself, which, you know, the idea of lasers blowing up a planet is a bit far-fetched.
My gosh.
But, you know, the idea of the interference of electromagnetic energy that you see depicted in the Death Star is certainly a scalar conception. So, yeah, you do find this thing in popular culture.
Okay. Well, thank you for that.
Wanted to give out your your website. I believe it's called Giza. Deathstar.wordpress.com. Is that correct?
That's correct. And Giza Death Star is all one word.
Yeah, G-I-Z-A, and then D-E-A-T-H-S-T-A-R.wordpress.com. Okay.
Right.
And your books, I bought one of your latest book from the Borders Bookstore here in Austin, so they're widely distributed all over the country.
And let's go ahead. All the titles, how many have... I've seen at least five, I think, right?
There are seven books, and in order of their publication, they are The Giza Death Star, The Giza Death Star Deployed, Reich of the Black Sun, The Giza Death Star Destroyed, The SS Brotherhood of the Bell, The Cosmic War, and then the last one is Secrets of the Unified Field, and then I'm writing one now. And I should mention that all my books are interrelated. So in other words, they all kind of intentionally dovetail into each other. So it may seem rather strange that I'm writing about Great Pyramids and Nazi secret weapons and cosmic wars, but
I was worried about that, Doctor. I think I understand now. Okay. Hey,
they all dovetail into each other.
Doctor, I was listening to you the other night on Coast to Coast with George Norrie.
Uh-huh.
There was a caller that called in. And put forward, he said something like this, I'm paraphrasing it. He said, Dr. Farrell and George Norrie, if y'all continue to do this research and in this direction, you're going to reach the conclusion that our pyramids were some kind of oscillation dissipators or something like that? Or so, was there any validity to what he said?
Well, yes, there is. There are basically three views, really. This alternative view of the Great Pyramid as a machine, and I should stress that I'm only talking about the Great Pyramid in those books, not all the other ones, because it's the Great Pyramid that most specifically exemplifies properties that engineers can associate with a machine. And I'm referring, of course, to the famous engineer Chris Dunn, who's written a whole book on the subject, just an excellent book called The Giza Power Plant. And he's an engineer, and he basically went to the Great Pyramid and examined it with an engineer's eye, and that's the conclusion that he came up to, was that it was some sort of machine. But I kind of take off from there, and I come to the conclusion in my mind, based on the physics and some of the ancient texts that I see in it, that it may have been a very, very ancient weapon of mass destruction of some sort that was just awesomely powerful. But there is another view, and it's been kind of put forward recently by Richard Hoagland. He came on the show on Coast during that last hour with me, and he put forward the view that it may have been some sort of defensive type of weapon, and I'm certainly open to that idea as well, because, you know, it's like you say, it's an oscillator of some sort. I think that's fairly conclusive on the basis of Dunn's research.
Would the pyramids, in Egypt and on Mars, would they be related in a like manner in some way?
Oh boy!
I've been at this for a long time, Doctor. I've listened to Coast for 15 years or something like that. So I'm a guru of Coast to Coast. Okay, I have all this stuff in my head. I don't have it, filed quite properly like you do already, right?
Well, I think you definitely are on to something there, and the reason why is, you know, Mr. Hoagland and his associate, Dr. Torin, Errol Torin, published a paper many years back in which they first came out with this whole idea of a tetrahedral physics that was encoded in the mathematical relationships there at Sidonia. Now, I find that very interesting because one of the things I do in my book called The Giza Death Star Deployed is I take the whole Giza compound and I rotate it through an axis of rotation that runs down through the Great Pyramid through 120 and 240 degrees, and I reproduce these diagrams in the book. When you do that and do kind of overlays of each rotation, what you end up with is a Star of David. In other words, you end up with a two-dimensional analog of tetrahedral three-dimensional physics. And, you know, that geometry just cannot be there in my mind by accident. It's not a coincidence that it's there. And it's precisely this kind of rotating physics, again, that's involved with this scalar, or if you prefer, with this torsion physics. So the compound itself looks to me like it's deliberately designed in some fashion that we do not yet know to tap into some of these higher dimensional types of physics.
Well, you know, that star that you describe, you know, is precedes any state of Israel or anything else.
Yes.
It's an ancient symbol, is it not?
Oh, yes. It's actually a Sumerian symbol.
Sumerian symbol.
Right.
What does it symbolize exactly, according to
your studies? Well, to my mind, I think that we, you know, my whole approach in all of my books is to examine the kind of the highways and byways of alternative physics and to look at how that really can be used as a way of interpreting events of history that otherwise make no sense. And as a result of that, when you take that approach and re-examine these ancient texts, Sumerian texts and Egyptian texts and so on, and look at them with an eye to finding possible evidence of the presence of that physics in ancient times, then it definitely pops out. So I think when you look at some of these symbols, what you're looking at is an ideogram precisely of this type of physics. And as you know, in Secrets of the Unified Field, I reproduce in one of the chapters what I call the swastika tensor.
I saw that.
That was very interesting.
Even the Nazi swastika is an ideogram, really, of this kind of rotating stress in the medium that is so much a fundamental part of this physics.
Well, now, as I understand it, the legs on that can be oriented either way.
Yes.
So the Nazis had theirs oriented in it in one way, and you see it in other ways also, the opposite legs in
that. Yes.
So is it a rolling sun? Is that what it is, the ancient symbol of a rolling sun or something like that?
Well,
or,
you know.
Or a tensor. You're saying some kind of maybe a high-tech symbol here.
Yes. I think that, you know, these symbols were chosen just to kind of sketch out the hypothesis that I lay out in the three pyramid books. I speculate that there was a very ancient high civilization that preceded all of our classical civilizations that we know, Egypt and so on and so forth. I call it that rather than Atlantis because I do not want to get involved in debates and discussions on where on earth Atlantis was.
Okay. Well, that could be a discussion, couldn't it?
That could be a very lengthy discussion.
Yes, sir.
It's been going on for quite a while.
It would take more than 2 hours to resolve.
It would take more.
A lifetime, right?
Well, yeah. But you see, the problem is that in these ancient texts, many of them suggest that this very high civilization was interplanetary in nature. So in other words, you have to look at all of these symbols on a multitude of levels at the same time.
Wow, and that was good.
Yeah, I think what you really have to do, and I attempt to do this very carefully in the books that touch directly upon this ancient history and physics and so on, you have to examine these texts very carefully. And I hear we're coming to a break, so we've got a full minute.
We've got a full minute in here before we go to break here. We've got probably 40 seconds.
Well, essentially, this leads to the idea then that you have to look at these symbols as being deliberately contrived by that civilization to preserve that very high physics.
Okay,
wow.
Let's pick up on those symbols when we come back. There's a six-minute break at the top of the hour, so if you need to go take care of business or whatever, it's a good time to do it. But we're going to be back approximately 6 minutes after the top of the hour. This is getting good. It's going to get better. Hang in there, listeners. Don't turn your dial. Dr. Farrow is coming back with more explosive symbols. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Doctor.